Welcome, everyone. It's really exciting to be back for another episode of the Sila series. With us today, I'm really excited to say that we've got Manuel Muñoz. Manuel is an incredible novelist. He's done some great work in the short story space. He is a recent recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, which I know we'll get into in a little bit on the episode today. But really excited to explore his career, his time at Cornell, and what it really means for him to be a Latino, both while he was on the hills in Ithaca and what he does today in his work. With that, Manuel, we want to welcome you to the podcast. Thank you for joining us, and would just take this opportunity to have you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you both for inviting me to be here and chatting with you. Where do I start? I'm in Tucson, Arizona right now. I'm a professor at the University of Arizona. I've been here for 15 years. It was my first academic job. Before that, I lived in New York City and I was working in publishing. I worked with a couple of different places, but that was the way that I was getting myself, you know, housed and fed while I was trying to be a short story writer in the big city. But I went to Cornell between 95 and 99. It was a two-year program, but then the Cornell MFA in creative writing also gives its graduates 2 years of teaching experience if you'd like to stay. So I stayed because it was a nice gig to be there for a little bit. Yeah.
And one of the things that we forgot to mention for our listeners as we jumped on was Manuel has been featured in many, many publications. His stories, what he does can be seen across many different mediums. But maybe Manuel, we'll start there and talk a little bit about your early career as you were in New York and your time at Cornell. What really led you on the path to say, one, I want to pursue an MFA, but really writing and in this style is something that was of passion for you and you wanted to continue to pursue in your professional career?
Well, I guess I have to go back even further. I graduated from Harvard in 94. And my first job right out of college was as a high school teacher, right across the street. Anyone who picked up my last book, The Consequences, will see an acknowledgement for a teacher named Donald Burroughs. And he was a really, really solid mentor for me. That's where I met him. He and another teacher named Joan Sobel, you know, they taught right across the street from Harvard. They knew the community. They knew Cambridge as a community. But teaching was a tough, tough gig. I mean, it was, you know, getting there at 7 in the morning. You're there until 4:30, and then you've got all this grading and you got to come up and do it all over again. And around October, after about 8 weeks of doing it, I thought, boy, maybe this isn't for me. And that's why I applied to the MFA program at Cornell. That's how I got there with some guidance, because I didn't even know really what a graduate program in creative writing was. But it's a dedicated space for writers to attend to their creativity and to try to shape a project. And that felt really, really exciting to me. And that's where, and I'm sure we're going to talk about her quite a bit, Elena Maria Viramontes, who became just a huge influence for me when I ran into her.
And maybe if I expand on that a bit, Manuel, what were some of the pieces that you picked up in writing, and especially as your time in Cambridge and at Harvard, that led you to say an MFA is part of what I will pursue? And how did Cornell become a piece of that for you?
Well, at Harvard, I didn't, as I said, I didn't really even know what a graduate degree, I didn't know a graduate degree in creative writing was possible. I had good mentors there who explained to me, you know, this is something you should look for and look for full funding. But I put it off because I thought there's no way that I would get into something that specialized. When I finally did get to Cornell and I had a meeting with Elena, my first meeting with her, she wanted to know how I had been trained at Harvard. What was my major? What did I study? And I was an English major, but much to my embarrassment, most of my studies was basically pre-Civil War. almost all was in Renaissance drama because I did a lot of Shakespeare study to complete my credits. And she was astounded. She said, you've never read one, Chicana text, nothing. I had to admit it, with a lot of shame, no. And she wrote down a whole bunch of titles, and she said, you need to go over to Eurus and check these books out. And the next time we meet, you will have read at least three of them. it was an education for sure. I mean, I really had to get up to speed, not just in terms of, I think Elena's point was, I'm here to support your creativity, but you need to know where you come from, and you need to know the lineage of people who have struggled to put their work out there when the publishing world had not been supportive of it. So, yeah.
On that note, we know that Cornell has had a plethora of amazing writers that have graduated from the institution. Can you talk a little bit about what ended up becoming your inspiration and some of the people who really provided you what you wanted to do as you thought about your voice? As you mentioned, Elena had kind of asked you and said, what does this mean for you as you start to become a writer in this space?
Well, that's I give Elena a lot of credit, but there's another writer there who was influential to me as well. The poet and the essayist Kenneth MacLean. He was the second reader on my committee, and he helped shape me in one in poetry, essay, which I couldn't do, but he has a really phenomenal book called Walls that I would read over and over again. We had a sort of common experience in thinking about family members who are incarcerated, and to think, what that kind of experience means for us and for them, and whether or not that's something that we have the courage to put on the page or not. One of the stories in Zigzagger kind of came from a conversation with him and a deliberation over an essay, from Walls. So he's definitely one of them. I mean, the thing about having mentorship is, as a young student, you go in thinking that you've got your own set of ideas and, trajectories for a project. But when you start reading with real masters of the word, you start to realize it's like, I've got to hone this even better. And so those two, Elena and Ken, were really instrumental in helping me do that.
One of the things that we've heard from many of the people that we've interviewed is the impact that Cornell has had on their career. The time that they spent in Ithaca and walking through the snow and through the sleet in those hills had for them. And obviously for a Latino, that can sometimes be even more impactful. Can you speak a little bit about what that time was like for you? And if you can think about it as a Latino, what did that mean for you? And where were the spaces that you were able to gravitate to or look to explore a little bit further when you were on the Hill?
Well, you're asking me this on a day, I think I was there just 2 weeks ago in Ithaca. There was a celebration of Elena on campus, and I was one of the people who had been invited to participate. So being there again, walking up the hill, and just kind of coming back to how I felt, there were a couple of important spots. I remember coming up the hill and getting by the library, and I remember, I think it was the first week that I was there, it was a beautiful sunny day, and the semester had just started. And remember, I had just gotten out of teaching 1 year. So I was accustomed and knew what it meant to be out of the cycle of school. And I was there with a deep appreciation. So I had that going for me, because the difficulty for me was that I was in a very small cohort of four people, of four writers. The other three had already published short stories in journals. And that is really intimidating, really, really intimidating. So I was starting to step into that swamp of imposter syndrome that I know a lot of people are familiar with. Like, you know, why did they choose me? I'm not as good as anybody else, and so on and so forth. But again, that's why those mentorships and their insistence, Ken's insistence and Elena's insistence, you come into office hours, we're going to talk this out, we're going to, you know, demand work from you, kind of really kept me going. And also remember, you know, my experience at Harvard kind of prepped me for it. You know, I think at Harvard, you know, if there's a regret in my education, it was being at Harvard and not knowing how to handle it. Whereas at Cornell, I was, you know, I'd been accustomed to the weather, I'd been used to this feeling, but I knew then it's like, oh, you've got resources here and you've got to make use of them. You can't do this by yourself. Yeah.
I know that one of the things that Joseph and I can probably relate with, as you tell your story, Manuel, is, you know, we both came into Cornell as graduate students. And I know exactly that feeling that you're speaking to, where maybe an undergraduate, as you spend time at 4 years or however long that experience is, you don't realize a lot of the resources, what is around you and how you can leverage that. I remember that vividly when I stepped on the Cornell campus. There was a different feeling there, that this time is a little bit different, right? It's a little bit more limited. I'd love to pick up on the conversations and the moments that we've spoken to already with Elena, as you talk about the time that you were able to spend with them, the mentorship that they provided. Can you speak a little bit about those relationships and how those have really impacted you past Cornell, but even at your time when you were at Cornell?
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak to one thing that I remember from Ken McLean. I remember after he read my thesis and I went through the defense, he said something to me about the male characters in them. He said, you know, Manuel, sometimes I think that you think men don't have interior lives. And the moment he said that, you know, he wasn't as, it was past the defense. But when he said that, it ignited something in me about what I was missing in some of my work. And I think that's one reason why in my short stories, I pay a lot of attention to how people feel inside and how I let those characters express it. Both of my mentors are very good at that. I mean, and it might sound like I'm talking more about Ken than I am about Elena, but Elena knows how often I sing her praises. I mean, I have a poster of her on my wall that I framed from one of her readings at George Washington University about, I think, 15 years ago. And I thought, oh, that is so iconic. I want that on my wall. But both of them did that. They, you know, they were able to crystallize conversations and aesthetic choices that I didn't yet have the capacity to really resolve, and sort of challenge me to sort of face those things before. Another Ken adage that he shared with me, I was having a really hard time generating work. And I remember meeting him in the hallway at Goldwin Smith. What are you working on? I'm not sure. I'm kind of struggling. I don't know what I'm doing. He said, well, what are you reading? And I didn't have anything at the ready. And he said, there's your problem. He said, reading is writing. He said, you need to have an answer at the ready. If there's not a book on your coffee table in your hand that you know that you are actively thinking about, he said, then yeah, I'll call you on it. You're not writing, which is it's a beautiful thing to say, you know? Yeah, so those are the kinds of things that I kind of keep going back to in terms of the conversations and the consejos that both of them were able to share with me.
And we know that mentorship is incredibly important. Maybe we can dive a little bit deeper. I know there's a few instances that you've mentioned already where Elena has been very impactful. Can you speak a little bit to, especially for a writer and a developing writer, how important is that mentorship? And how have both of those mentors been able to really impact you? You spoke a little bit about some of the advice that they've given you. How did that provide you a guide and a path that you needed when you were at Cornell?
I have, you know, I teach graduate students now and undergraduates, and I see all the impatience that I had when I was a student. And I now know what my mentors meant at Cornell to take heed of our own time. You know, just take time to make sure that you're shaping exactly what you want to put out there, because once it's out in the world, it's not yours anymore. People will read it in particular ways. They'll critique it in particular ways, and you don't get a do-over. And I recall that now, you know, because something happens, I think, when we're young and starting out, where we want everything to happen quickly. And I think what both Elena and Ken were able to demonstrate to me, and this is why I always go back to that first meeting with her when she was appalled that I hadn't read. You know, she said something about learning the history and the struggles that these writers had simply to get their work into different kinds of presses. Also, even learning the literary history of small presses, especially on the West Coast, was something that I needed to take into account, you know. And that became an exploration in its own way. I remember like kind of going through the stacks of Eurus and finding, you know, copies of little books from presses that aren't around anymore, but had a couple of titles in the 70s and the 80s. They're, I mean, really fantastic names. Relampago Press, you know, Sandia Press, which may be still around, I'm not sure, from New Mexico. You know, what's another one? Mano Izquierda. I mean, really just kind of really cool names. Yeah, so when I think back to you know, what they were able to impart on me as a young writer in getting me to slow down and to measure success in another kind of way. Because I have to say, I understand it. With my students, I always talk about the importance of practicing writing because we have a love for the art. And I hated hearing that when I was young, because I want the publication, I want the recognition, I want the validation. But as I've gotten older, it's no. I mean, my mentors were absolutely right. You know, that there is something very healing and very good for the soul to just simply concentrate on the capacity to use language in that way. You know, to start every day with reading, you know, a little bit of fiction, or I do poetry, and to just to meditate on the fact that, you know, if we're granted this gift, to use it and to use it to its best devices. Yeah. And if it sounds like I'm talking like, what? Let me tell you, get 30 minutes with Elena Maria Viramontes, and she'll convince you absolutely that, because she says writing is sacred. It's sacred, and she's absolutely right.
Are you able to recall any of those books that she recommended that you go check out of Eurus when you first met with her?
Oh, there were a ton. I mean, Bernice Zamora, I remember. And Bernice Zamora was not one of the first. What I mean was, like, I had not yet encountered Lorna de Cervantes, the poet. I had read only one book of poetry by Gary Soto. I had not encountered Alberto Rios. This is just the poetry. You know, never mind Dagoberto Gil. You know, I had read Sandra Cisneros. Ana Castillo was one I had not read. You know, she's like, she just came out with a book last year, Manuel. I mean, it was so far from God. This was 1994. And you haven't read this book? And I remember, actually, it was interesting because when I was in Ithaca and we were driving, I guess we were being driven back to the hotel, and I remember passing the park where it was the first couple of weeks after speaking with Elena that I had a copy of So Far From God. And it was a really beautiful sunny day in the park, and I was reading the book in that park. And I said, yeah, that's the one. But those were some of the titles. And then, but it went further, you know, Bernice Zamora I mentioned because I think it was, what was the name of that book? It's not, Stella Portillo Trambley, Reign of Scorpions was another. You know, as we went further and further down the line, she said, you know, there are going to be some authors who only had one or two books, but were big voices in the 70s and the 80s. And they may not be spoken about in the academy as much, but you need to go look for them. So yeah, that's where I was in terms of the lack of reading.
Yeah. And Manuel, I've heard you mention a lot of Latino and Latina authors. Mm-hmm. Is that intentional? Was that something that Elena imprinted on you? Is that something that you gravitated to as you were at Cornell, or is that by accident?
Well, I do have to say, you know, the one exception to my, you know, my miseducation was I took a really great seminar at Harvard called Black Women and Their Fiction with Henry Louis Gates. So like out of the blue, it's like, you know, Renaissance drama and then this, like, how did that happen? And it was one of my best classes. So I think when I told Elena, you know, what those titles were, you know, Gail Jones, Toni K. Bambara, Toni Morrison, of course, my favorite novel of all time, Maud Martha by Gwendolyn Brooks, that's where I discovered that. She said, that's actually what you need for, you know, for our lit. And to remember, as she said, you know, there's a template that the Black writers provided for us in terms of how they were approaching publishing and how they were embracing different styles and different approaches. And that's why you have this beautiful variety of writers and stories that you can tell. She says that that's actually a great, you know, a great resource. So I was reading those writers as well, but that's when I kind of realized, I didn't even realize the impact of that course while I was in it. Mm-hmm. It was Elena who came to me and she said, you kind of need a, you know, the one like that, a survey course, essentially, yeah. You know, to understand where they come from. Yeah.
And then can you speak a little bit to how you read so many of these incredible authors, that mentorship that you were provided at Cornell? How did that then fuel your writing style, choose the path of how you wanted to have your words come to life on a page?
Elena's challenge to me was, you know, see what's there, recognize that you're not going to like all of it, but what's your space within it? I mean, the missing point here for me, though, is that I wasn't out yet. I came out, I want to say, spring semester of my first year. I don't remember when it was. Might have been second. I'm so long ago now. But that was the missing factor. And Elena even, and I came out to Elena. She's one of the first people I came out to. And she even said to me at one point, after we'd had the conversation and been, you know, working and so forth. And she said, you know, Manuel, your writing has gotten a lot more honest because you've been honest with yourself. And that was also for me looking at the literature and realizing there's a big gap here. There are some voices that are missing. And mine is one of them in that regard. And she also said something very important to that. She said, just remember, Manuel, just because the voice has not been archived does not mean that it wasn't there. She said, I knew plenty of queer writers in the 70s, but the, you know, the times were not allowing them. That's how huge the barrier was. Not to mention, you know, what happened with HIV/AIDS that stole so many of those writers from our history. So, you know, again, you know, she helped me contextualize a lot of what that meant and what that meant for me personally and where I would be, you know, how I would be coming into the slipstream of our literature.
Manuel, thank you for sharing that. I think it's evident for me and probably our listeners how incredibly profound, not just those conversations with Elena were, but as you continue to transform throughout your time at Cornell, what that meant for your own work and how that would imprint on what you would come to write to be some incredibly gifted writing. Can you talk a little bit about, as you stepped away from Cornell when you were getting ready to graduate, what were some of those things that you hung on to that are most imprinted on you for this is what's going to guide me as I leave Ithaca, and also how that really led to you as you walked away from Cornell?
I started to realize, you know, as I got out of the MFA realm, and I wasn't workshopping anymore. It's important to point out that when I was a student, I was working on a novel. When it turned out, much to my surprise, that I was a short story writer, because once I was out of the workshop, I worked on short stories, because I didn't have to show them to anybody. And I realized that I was actually really good at them. One of the first ones I wrote, it was called Campo. I wrote it at College Town Bagels at the very top. I remember being there with my notebook, and I like the first lines came, and I don't want to say it came easily, but it felt like, oh, this is so, you know, this is a breeze.
I mean, it's not a bad place to write, right?
Right. And I don't know if it's like that still, but there was like that outdoor patio, you know. And, you know, I typed it up and I sent it out, and it got accepted in a big journal called Glimmer Train. And man, I got humbled fast, because I thought, oh, you know, if I can get into Glimmer Train, orale, let's go. You know, and I started writing all these stories.
The rest is cake.
Yeah. And yeah, I sent those out and they got rejected quickly. but what I started to realize at that point, because I was showing Elena these stories, and she was, as always, very supportive, but luego se me prendió el foco. Like, I just, I realized, you know what? Elena's got her workshop. She's got students. She's like, I have to do this on my own. Like, I can't keep, coming to her, like, for her stamp of approval. Like, and I think that was part of her, also her mentorship. Because remember, well, I didn't say this yet, but I was a very, very quiet student. And she, pobrecita, she struggled to get words out of me and was just confounded. She said, you know, Manuel, on the page, I just find you so, articulate and sharp. But in the classroom, you don't say anything.
He says nothing.
And it's like, you got it. You have to. She said, because sooner or later, you will be completely on your own. And you're going to have to, in order to convince an agent or an editor, you're going to have to talk, right? And, and I realized, yeah, you know, I got to start being more self-sufficient and pull away. From not pull away completely from mentorship, because we remained good friends, but I realized I've got to trust myself, as she's been instructing me this entire time. Trust your voice. Be your own editor. Be your sharpest critic. And that's what I started to develop into as I left.
And then as you moved on from Cornell and took those first steps, were you able to align yourself to say, you know, short stories are where my voice comes out best? Or where was the pathway where you said, this is how I want to start to write? This is where I'm seeing my ability to get published. This is where I have the ability to show what I can do. How did you get to that point? And has that changed at all throughout your career as you've continued to write?
Well, Cornell did me a great favor, because at the time, and I don't know if this is true anymore, but in the 90s, the faculty, I think to a one, were all against what we called the professionalization of writing, meaning they always said, do not fool yourself into thinking you have to have a teaching job in order to be a writer. Yeah. Elena always told me, as long as you have a 9-to-5 with good health benefits, you're good to go, but you need to give yourself the space to write without the financial worry. Health benefits, Manuel, health benefits. Just make sure you can find a job that has that. And that's why when I went to Boston and got a publishing job, and then New York at the same time. And I thought, yeah, they're right. I can work this. I can, there's no pressure other than what I want for myself to publish a big book, or, you know, I don't have to satisfy, you know, the university always looking down on your shoulder to see your productivity or whatever. And that's why my first book, Zigzagger, I was able to take 7 years to write it and to shape it and to look for a place, like to rise. I didn't even realize truly the challenge of what I was doing, which was writing a book of queer short stories that you really hadn't seen that a lot in our literature. You know, we had Gil Quadros and we had Arturo Islas, but not very many. In fact, one press that turned down, it was University of Arizona Press, where ironically I teach now.
You're at now, yeah.
Yeah, and they turned down Zig Zagger. And the editor said to me, "We don't think the community's ready for these stories."
Wow.
This is 2003. This is only 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of what I was up against and not realizing I was up against it. So I'm glad I kind of carved my own path, and I carved it largely through the small press arena, and I did it through short stories, even though the literary world basically wants a novel all the time. You know, that's where the big money is. But, you know, I was trained to respect my art, and my art was in the short story. So, you know, that's how that, I've never been shaken from that. Well, we'll talk a little bit about why there was a big gap between my novel and the consequences. It was 11 years, so maybe I was shaken a little bit, sure. But I stuck to the short story, and you know, here we are.
And maybe we'll give you some time to talk about that. We'd love to learn a little bit more about, as your books were written, the process you took to get them to be published, and what that life looked like post-Cornell as you really got into the ability to write at your leisure at the time that worked best for you, and how you got to the point to say, this is ready, I want others to see this.
Yeah. Well, Zig Zagger kind of was its own journey. That's the first book. There's a great story behind that, because I had, as I said, I've been rejected by so many places. And there were two other writers at the time that I was in contact with, Rich Yanez and Rigoberto Gonzalez, who both had the manuscript. And they had found out about a new imprint at Northwestern University Press called Latino Voices. And they said, you should send this out to them. And I said, I don't think so. Just get, you know, based on these rejections, I think this one's over. I need to start a new book. They submitted the manuscript for me. And the editor reached out to them to say, hey, who is this guy? You have an email for him? Because I need to get in touch with him.
Wow.
And that was Rigoberto Gonzalez sends me the email. He says, hey, they're trying to get in touch with you. You know, he says, you know, make sure you contact them. And then the second email as a follow-up, and don't fuck it up. That's how that happened. You know, kind of small steps, you know, and then, you know, I had an agent, got an agent, and then I got a 2-book deal with Algonquin. And that's where Faith Healer of Olive Avenue, my second collection, came. And then a novel called What You See in the Dark came out in 2011. But it wasn't a good relationship. And I left the press, and I was at a point where I thought maybe I made the wrong decision. I should, you know, go back to small press publishing, or, you know, just short stories. And that's where that huge lull came, you know, to the point where people were asking me, it's like, hey, what's going on? Like, where's your next book? It's been 5 years. It's been 7 years. It's been 9 years. I'm working. But when you say that to people, people never believe you. But yeah, there was that little lull there where I thought I'd made a major misstep, but I didn't. I stuck to short stories. Yeah.
And what helped you come out of that space where you knew you were working, you knew you were doing the right thing that was best for you? What was it that kept you grounded and allowed you to continue to move forward?
Elena's consejos, for sure. You know, I mean, you know, and, you know, she would make no bones about telling me, you know, because we'd speak on the phone every now and then. She says, hey, Manuel, look how long I take between books. I take as long as I need to. I take as long as the novel demands, you know. And you look at her timeline. Her first book came out in 85. That was The Moths. Her second book, Under the Feet of Jesus, 1995. Her third book, Their Dogs Came With Them, 2007. And everyone is just at the ready, because we already know that the title of the fourth book is The Cemetery Boys. And like little pieces of it are starting to pop up in journals. Like just yesterday, The Common out of Amherst published an excerpt. There's one in Huizache that's coming out of UC Davis. So everyone knows, but look at that, from 2007 to 2023. But, you know, so like her belief in herself and her, you know, her ability to say, you know, my art matters more than someone else's clock is really like a good lesson for me. And it was the first time I had ever really encountered that, because I was, you know, I was now working at the university. And for those who, you know, are in academia, you know, that pressure of people doing, you know, like you're always on the, you know, what did you do this year? What did you publish this year? And she rejects all that. It's like, that's not what we're here for as writers. So yeah, it's Elena again, once and always.
I really love the notion that you mentioned that the art should not be revolving around a clock, and that it should really come out in what it means for you and what the novel demands or the story demands.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's true. It's true. The work has to last longer than you do.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you are now at Arizona, you're teaching. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to know, how much have you carried the consejos that you've heard throughout your life from those that we've mentioned? And how do you imprint that now as a professor onto your students? And how do you try to bring some of those lessons that you picked up at Harvard and Cornell to the students you're teaching in Tucson?
I'm always on the lookout for the quiet students. And I pay attention to the students who are brilliant on the page, but are afraid to speak. And to just get them out of the notion of that participating in class, you know, doesn't equal to like always having to be right. You know, I think you just have to try out your ideas, you know, and just to encourage them. You know, I don't want to go as far as to say I see a lot of myself in some of these students, because everybody has their own reasons for being quiet or for feeling out of place. But I always want them to know, you know, whether it's because, you know, you're a first gen student, or because you feel like everybody in class is smarter than you or something, you're wrong. The fact is, if you're in the space, you were chosen to be in the space. And I want my students to remember that at every single step. You know, I sympathize with those of them who have, you know, really heavy cases of imposter syndrome, pero también I tell them, it can be a phenomenal waste of your time, you know, if you don't allow yourself to embrace the fact that people have chosen you to be in a space. You must remember that. So that's really where I am, you know, like that's why, you know, I'm mostly slated to teach larger courses, like 40 people, like lecture style, which is fine. But in the small seminars, you know, where they've gotten into, you know, a 15-person workshop, that's where I start to see, you know, how detrimental it is for them to still be quiet as juniors and seniors. It's like, no, you've got to take the space to have some courage and feel safe to try out some ideas.
I think your words of you were chosen to be in this space, and as high as that imposter syndrome may be, it is a monumental waste of time. I think I could have used those words when I was at Cornell. I think we all go through that and we feel that.
Yeah. Because I know we feel that way. And again, like I said, I'm sympathetic to my students for feeling that way. But the top idea at the top of our head should be, I was chosen to be here. And my work should speak for itself. My intellect should speak for itself. And that's what I hope to impart on my students.
That's incredible. Manuel, you were recently chosen for quite a great award. For those of our listeners that don't know, Manuel Munoz was recently chosen as a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner, an incredible honor from the John T. and Catherine D. MacArthur Foundation. Manuel, I'll put you on the spot for a little bit. And it's an incredible honor, Manuel. And obviously, as someone from the institution, someone who's a Latino, it's something that comes with a lot of orgullo. We'd love to hear from you, you know, what that process was like for you and what it means and what it can provide for others.
Well, the thing that listeners should know is that you don't apply for it, and you don't even know that you're nominated for it. You just don't know. I mean, the call, when they say it comes out of the blue, it truly comes out of the blue. But I have, you know, this only happened, you know, 2 months ago, because I knew ahead of time. and it has to be kept secret for a month. You can tell one person. But I was having a really hard time understanding it, accepting it. I think the best way that I've been able to embrace it is to see how happy people, just how happy people in our community have been about what the award means to all of us. Because I think it's true. You know, when one of us gets recognized in a big way like that, it sends a signal to the entire world. You've been missing. You have been missing out on what we have been doing collectively. Collectively. If there's one of him, there's more. You see what I mean? I think that sort of sense of, you know, how proud people were on my behalf was just, that's what made me feel better about it. Because by myself, I felt like, God, this makes no sense whatsoever. But when other people talk a little bit more about, you know, what this has meant to the entirety of our literature and the great strides that we have been making without the world really wanting to notice. I mean, or the national literary scene really wanting to notice, means a lot to me. Yeah. And then again, you know, I was just at Cornell, so I could see Elena in person to thank her for it. I mean, Cheri Moraga was there. You know, can you imagine getting congratulations about something like this from Cheri Moraga? All of these, you know, phenomenal scholars that work on, on Elena's words, you know, recognize what the award meant. You know, so it was, that was an important, I love how La Divina Providencia brought that kind of event right at the announcement so that it could help me process it and appreciate it and really receive it with gratitude.
I think it's incredibly powerful when you think about, you know, the people who have come before through that award. And obviously it's evident to us how meaningful it is for you, Manuel, but also what it means for the community. And as you've mentioned, for the entire literary world who sees that. And as members on SILA, as Latinos who have graduated from this institution, it shows the pedigree of the people who you have said have been chosen to represent not just who they are, but who they are through the lenses of these incredible institutions that we get to attend and be a part of and then represent afterwards. So congratulations from both of us. And es un orgullo inmenso.
Gracias. Muchísimas gracias.
Manuel, this has been an incredible interview. We cannot thank you enough. As we wrap up, we've got a few more questions for you. We do have to put you on the spot. What are you currently reading and what are you most excited about that you're either writing or you're currently reading? As you mentioned, reading is writing.
Yeah, I'm currently reading Justin Torres's book, Blackouts. Some people who are, you know, follow like the year-to-year literature on it, like what's out right now, know that that's the hot book. It's nominated for the National Book Award. It's beautifully produced. If you get yourself into a bookstore, just go pick it up and hold it in your hands. It's a marvelous book. As I think it's divided into six parts. And I read the first part last night, and it's phenomenal.
Is there anything you want to share with our listeners about what you're currently writing?
Oh, you know, I am starting work on another short story collection. I had been saying to a lot of people that The Consequences was going to be my last book because I had been struggling so much. And then I changed my mind in the summer. And I said, you know, this is still worth the fight. And then all these really wonderful things started to happen. So now it's like, ni modo, you have to. But I just feel empowered on it. I guess because I never like to talk about what's in the works, but it looks like a group of five really long stories, and they are centering around a man who leaves his family. Ultimately, I know I'm kind of writing about my biological father. I never met him, but I've started to write some essays about what that experience is like, and I have a feeling maybe now at 51, I'm getting ready to, you know, like really encounter what that means. So I think that's where I'm going. We'll see.
That's exciting. We look forward to it.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for students and for alumni who are both at Cornell now or maybe recently graduated from the institution?
I think for students, definitely get into the habit of office hours. Just go, you know, because those individual one-on-one conversations, even when you think you've got no agenda, like, oh, I have to go there just to ask for something. No, just go for 15 minutes, you know, and just say, hey, I just wanted to go meet you. I think professors really appreciate that. I mean, I tell my students all the time, I said, I have my office hours these times and half the time they're empty. Well, don't we have to be there to, you know, to do something official? I said, no, just come say hi. Just come say, hey, you know, what movie did you go see at the Loft Cinema? Like, whatever. I get to know you. Those are the important ones. And for the alumni, you know, just, you know, to reach out every now and then to those mentors who are still there and remind them that they've done good work, because, you know, they deserve to be thanked. And they also deserve, you know, to know that their work is meaningful, because all of us, no matter what kind of public face we put on, struggle with our 9-to-5, and that includes our professors and our mentors. And it means a lot when, you know, you get a little note or some other thing that just checks in to say, hey, I'm not even, you know, asking you for a rec letter or nothing. I'm just saying, I'm thinking about you and thank you. You know, it's a small thing, small gesture.
Gracias for what you've done and you continue to do.
Thank you both for chatting with me today. I appreciate it.
Manuel, this has been an incredible interview. We can't thank you enough. We know you mentioned Harvard quite a few times. We won't hold that against you as Cornelians. We do want to give you the opportunity to have la última palabra. And we'd love for you to send us off on this episode in whatever way makes sense for you. But we want to thank you. This has been an incredible time for us to learn more about you, your work, and the impact that Cornell has had. But we'd welcome any parting thoughts you have for our audience.
I mean, right now, these are difficult days. It always feels like they're difficult days, but sometimes more than others. But as I've gotten older, I've understood what it means to practice gratitude. And sometimes it means saying things aloud to certain people. So that's what I'm going to ask that listeners do. It could be someone in your family. It could be somebody that you're good friends with, somebody who helped you out. But just to say those words, gracias, and to mean it sincerely, and to do it in person if you can, believe me, it helps the soul. It's good.